And good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is hour two of our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft, the controls this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. The History Detectives is one of the most popular programs these days on public television. Since 2003, the show has pursued historical mysteries with the help of family stories and also interesting objects. And the result is an often surprising new take on our nation's history. This morning, in this hour of the show, we have as our guest one of the history detectives. Her name is Gwendolyn Wright, and she is a professor of architecture at Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. Also has joint appointments in the departments of art history and history. And since 2001, she has been one of the hosts of the PBS show History Detective. She is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. Her visit here is sponsored by the folks at the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities, and she'll be giving a talk tonight at 7:30 in the Levis Center on the third floor, and this is open to anybody who is interested, and she'll be talking about the approach to history that they take on the show, on the History Detectives, and that's also what we'll be doing here this morning on the program, and questions are welcome. I expect some people who are listening to us have seen the show. Maybe they'll want to call in and talk about a favorite episode or perhaps ask some questions, and all of that is welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and if you'd like, you can also send an email. You can communicate that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much.
I'm delighted to be here.
I know that a lot of people like the program, and I've seen in interviews you're talking about the fact that you could be walking down the street and people recognize you and they stop and they honk their horn and they say, love that show. And
it's
those
bizarre.
Are not professional historians. Those are regular folks.
It's very funny to have this happen in New York because, of course, most New Yorkers have their outside face in which you don't engage other people because it's so crowded. And so sometimes somebody comes up to me and says, Gwen, and I look at them. I don't know you. Why should I talk to you? And I have to remind myself that here is this other public persona. But it's one of the things I love about doing the show is a lot of professionals, including professional historians who had always been suspicious of television like it, but a lot of people of incredibly varied backgrounds that all have museum guards come up to me. And it's very nice that they're is a sense of the excitement of history among this diverse population.
Well, I think I read somewhere that in the beginning when you were first getting involved or talking about getting involved that maybe some other people, some colleagues had said to you, well, Gwen, I'm not so sure this is a good idea that if you do this, then that it might damage your reputation as an academic historian.
That indeed happened. A lot of people told me that I would not be taken seriously if I agreed to be on television. And I felt it should be the other way around, that we have obligations as professionals, no matter what our field is in universities, to have exchanges about the way that we approach things as well as the topics that we take up. And I have a sense of mission in part about doing this show. It helps Americans think about the dilemmas of the present day. It's what good history does. It's not why we do it, but it's one of the aspects of thinking in a critical manner. And I'm happy to say that there are now a lot of professional historians in universities around the country who love the show because we're showing why history is exciting, why it's important, and how we do it.
Yeah, I think it's really too bad that there are people who still seem to feel that television is just irredeemable and that certainly they would say, oh, well, you can't really do serious education on television. It's just you just can't do it. And personally, I think public television actually does a pretty good job of doing that. But the fact that people should still disparage it and say, oh, well, no, it's just not possible. Don't even try. I think that's kind of disappointing.
It is disappointing. But what's been nice is that that tenor has changed. And there are now professional historians. There are people in professional schools. Doctors love it. My internist says, it's like diagnosis. It's so exciting. You have a lot of different points of view. You have to use your background and your intuition. And I think that the response is now quite positive.
I think it just the story of how the program came to be is interesting. And that you got involved because you're an architectural historian. And when they started out, the idea was just to do something about buildings, about houses. And they thought, well, okay, I guess we should have an architectural story. And that would be the kind of person that we would need. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how the program actually came to be.
Well, it's actually quite amusing because it began with a group of British television producers who came over and made a contract with PBS for a pilot to look at American houses and to have it be a combination of someone like me exploring the cultural background for different kinds of dwellings that we have, of houses in that 19th century are different from houses in the late 20th or the 21st century. And then to have some people who do a kind of antiques roadshow approach of looking at the provenance, the meaning, and the varieties of objects. Well, they were going to call it American Attic. And we told them, first of all, you're Brits. You say that very clearly. Most Americans would say American Attic, and it would sound like it was a drug program. And so we should start off changing the title. But it's also the case, something that I've worked on throughout my career and find fascinating, Americans have so many myths about their houses. People who have a colonial revival house often come to believe that it was built in the colonial era. There is, by and large, a notion, my house is different from the other houses on the block, and we go out of our way to make this be the case. So we told them they would have a lot of stories that actually weren't true, maybe more stories than they wanted to have. And I also, at the very beginning, and I got a chance to discuss this here in Champaign a number of years ago when the librarians here on the campus invited me to come give a talk. So I insisted that they couldn't have it be one house every week, that reinforces the notion of the perfect American house. And we have many different ways of living. So they should have three different segments. At least one should be a multi-unit dwelling. It could be a dorm. It could be an apartment building. And at least one should be a radically different class. So I suggested if you're going to have a big house, have the home of the woman who's the maid. And let's look at the kinds of homes, the personalization, the types that we have, and the objects that have meaning and history in different kinds of dwellings. And I was so pleased because the next day I got a phone call from someone else with whom they were doing a screen test. And he said, I guess they talked to you because they came in this morning and said, we've changed the format of the program. And so they did it instantly.
And so now, perhaps for people who have not seen the program, what happens is each episode is an hour long. Each has three stories within it. And the idea is that you're trying to connect people with history by using some kind of object, some kind of physical object. And I was just looking at some of the, in your ninth season, some of the things that you have there. And it's a wide array of things made out of paper. There was a cannon and a bullet and a saddle and a Ronald McDonald suit and all kinds of things like that. And you take that thing and you try to figure out, well, what is it? Where did it come from? What is it all about? And tell a story around that then you can use to tell a larger story about some idea or period or theme in American history.
Well, let me present it in a slightly different way, that each one of the segments is focused on an object. And as you say, it could be a book or a drawing. It could be a marine blouse at one point. It could be an 18-pound shell I had to carry around to all the different places we went. And the person who brings it in has a question. Now, sometimes we push a certain question. Why was this made at this time? Can this give us some insights into the role that John Adams took as the second president of the United States and his strange relationship with his son? So we ask a certain question, and then we show how a historian would go about investigating that. Now, what's nice about the object is that it allows us to look at economic history, at the history of aesthetics, at political aspects, and nobody ever says, wait, you were just talking about how much this cost, and now you were discussing food at that time. But all of them, by having the object, come together.
Yeah, it gives you a point of focus that you can, say, take side trips, but it always gives you something that you can go back to because you have this thing that's right at the heart of it. And it does have a little, and I don't mean to say this in any disrespectful way, but it does have a little Antiques Roadshow kind of tinge to it, because it's individuals, it's people who have things that they may be an heirloom, they may be a family artifact, it may just be something that they've acquired, who knows what. But what they're really, they're wanting to know more about that that thing and what it is and what it means?
Well, they want to know that. One of the points from the beginning that was an interesting debate is, what is value? And for many Americans, they actually wanted to know how much it was worth on the market. And because this isn't Antique Shred Show, we have two wonderful colleagues who come from that. But we were expanding the notion of the market value to look at historical value, to look at the ways in which we can understand ourselves within a family, within a community, within national and global perspectives through these, and to emphasize the historical value. In fact, many things that we've looked at have ended up in museums. Once the sense of that significance is made clear, then museums want to have those objects. So we've expanded using a strong base of Antiques Roadshow and the enthusiasm for that to remind people there are many kinds of value.
Yeah. Well, I think that what comes through very clearly is people when in their thinking about the value of the object and what you've told them, monetary value is not that's not the thing. I mean, to them, the value is having some kind of meaning attached to it, and you know, maybe for some of these people, not all, but it's a way for them personally to connect to history, which I think is something that people find very, you know, very difficult to do. That may indeed have something to do with the way that we teach it, as some kind of series of isolated events happened a long time ago. And, you know, it's the old thing about memorizing dates and places and names, and it being very difficult for people to connect with that in any sort of meaningful way.
Well, that's a critique that's often made. As a professional historian, I don't want to say that's how we teach history. It is the experience that, unfortunately, many people have had. But we show that you need the dates, you need the chronology, you need the various facts that you can find, but they're often contradictory facts that we bring to bear on this. But it's to show that, on the one hand, there are many kinds of value, but also that the objects around you help you understand the history of your own family in many cases, but also these questions of regional history. The Civil War, seen from the North and the South, was one of the ones that we did just this last year. And it reminds people that they can engage history in a broader sense. And we show them that there are many historians who do that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Gwendolyn Wright. She is professor in the Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation at Columbia University. And she is one of the hosts of the PBS, very popular PBS television series, History Detectives, and has been right since the show started. It was 2003?
That's right. And, of course, 2002 is when they began doing this. And they were looking around for a range of kinds of historians. And I thought, well, they're going to come to a screen test, but I'm not of the age that you usually hire people to be on camera. And yet I get very enthusiastic about how we ask historical questions and how we then explore these. And they were enthusiastic from the start, too. Mm.
And we have a caller here. And if, for folks who are listening, if you would like to call in, ask a question, maybe you've seen the program, have something to say about it, you can do that. Talk with one of the hosts here, one of the detectives, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have somebody here from not too far away, Belgium, line number 4 on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. Mr. Inge, a few days ago, replayed a show that he had from earlier in this year of a professor there in Champaign who does pre-Columbian studies of Cahokia. And he was given a question about what would he prefer to do, look into history that is recorded or look into history of people who don't really record it, and you have to just look at what they left behind to find the story. Now, I thought that was a very interesting question, or a very interesting way to look at it, because so much of history can be modified, just like you're saying. And so even though the story you tell about the object that is found or thought to be valuable or whatever, that history can be modified in so many different ways. And which would you prefer to do? Look into the history of somebody who hasn't spoken about it so you can find out what truly was said, or somebody who has recorded it and have their point of view?
Well, it's a wonderful question, although I would insist that objects are a way of recording history, too. And I like the fact that we can encourage people to see that drawings and paintings and objects of everyday life, we've had silverware, for instance, that we've looked at, those are ways of understanding history. It's not one versus the other, and that both of them can give us insights and both of them can lead us astray to get an idea about what happened that might be one-dimensional.
Thank you very much.
Right, thank
you. Thank you. Other questions, comments are welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest this morning, this hour, is Gwendolyn Wright. She's one of the hosts of the PBS show History Detectives. So you literally have thousands of people writing to you. They are writing in to suggest things you might take up, questions they submit, saying, I have this thing and I think it might be interesting. How do you go about selecting which objects and which questions you'd like to investigate?
Well, we get about 1,500 submissions per year. Now, half of them are, my Aunt Gertrude disappeared 10 years ago. Can you help me find her? So we put those aside. But we also take up and do initial investigations. We call them reconnaissance or recce, to see what kind of evidence we can find, what the process of the looking will be. It's more about that than it is whether we can have an answer at the end. Sometimes we'll come back and say, I can't tell you. But there is an excitement about a range of topics, making sure that they're not too much about one family, but that that family, in asking questions that might be revealing difficult things about their own history, helps us understand other dimensions of American history. We call it the so what factor. What do we learn about in taking on a very specific object that might have to do with one person's history?
So you might come across something that was you might think would be interesting, but you said, well, we've kind of been there, so you're trying to, I'm sure, cover some as wide a kind of territory as you possibly can.
We do. There is obviously a great deal of interest in the history of American military life. So we've had a number of stories about World War II and about the Civil War. But we try to have each one of them open up dimensions that haven't been explored so visibly. For instance, I had a story just this summer that was about a doll that was in the Museum of the Confederacy that was supposedly used to carry contraband medicines to Confederate soldiers on the front. So I liked that because it expanded us off the battlefield. Most of the histories about the Civil War look at the strategic moves of the North or the South, and this reminded us that an important part of the history took place in those military hospitals and was involving women who weren't combatants but who were playing a major role in moving intelligence and then moving these medications.
Well, let us talk with, we have some other callers. Let's talk with someone else. Someone on a cell phone, I believe. Let's go to line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
So wonderful to have Gwen in town. I love the show. My husband and I watch it, try to catch every airing of it. What I like about the show is through these objects and through your research, you get personal connections to something that happened in the past. And to me, I'm a storyteller and I do historical stories. To me, that's the clue about loving history, is that we can make a connection with someone who wasn't famous or might not have had a big role in a big event, but we can learn how people felt and acted. And that's why I love your show, because it makes those personal connections for us.
Well, I appreciate that very much. It's one of the fundamental ideas about the show, is to look at the history of people who might have been minor actors in the past, but whose lives at a certain point, whether it's the Civil War or the second presidency in the United States, can give us insights into larger factors. Now, it's important because it's doing both. And I think we sometimes have an artificial split. Either it's about personal life and family life, or it's about major events. And one of the strengths of the show is to connect those, that the life of someone who might have made the engine that was on Charles Lindbergh's plane is as interesting as Lindbergh himself.
Yes. I do have one question. It seems, of course, when you do it on TV, to be very easy to do. You show us all your successes. I'd like to hear about how many dead ends you meet along the research before you can find the provenance of the piece. And I'll hang up now. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for that question as well. One of the things we try to do, and it's a challenge for television, is to show the dead ends, to show that we're sitting in a library and not finding anything that's very useful. Now, that's hard to present, and you don't want to spend too much time showing dead ends, but we try to bring in those actualities and then find ways of flashing through it and showing the books moving from one side of the table to the other as you go through them all and can't find anything that's very useful. But we all know that sometimes in the course of doing work that seems a dead end, you realize that one group might not have been involved in this, that you get an answer by a dead end. It tells you a line that might not be as important as you thought. And it reminds us that it's work. Sometimes you'll have learned something that later on will give you an insight. It's not going to be, here's the answer in great lights.
Hmm. But you were an historian, a professional historian, before you started doing this. Has your involvement with the program done anything to the way you think about what history is or how you do it?
Well, it's probably closer to how I've approached history than you're suggesting. What it's helped with is my teaching, that I think I'm much more engaged in posing rhetorical questions to students. Even in a big lecture class of 200 students, I'll say, now wait, what do you think we could do with this? What do you see in this map? Why do you think this person might have made that decision? And there's often a bit of an awkward pause. And then the students begin raising their hands, and they almost always have different points of view. And it helps them realize there are different perspectives in the past and in the present. So I like that. It's made me be a much better teacher.
All right. Another caller here. We have someone in Tolono. We'll go there. Line one. Hello.
Well, hello. I only tuned into the radio or into the show a little bit late, and I was really fascinated about, you know, taking personal items and finding the history on them. Do you have any way that someone could do that, like not being part of your show?
We try to show various ways that anyone can do. How do you use libraries? To realize that librarians want to help you. You can go ask them for advice about what kinds of documents might help you. We also try to take an expert who we're interviewing and say, well, wait a minute, slow down for a second. How did you know that? What did you look at? How can you tell when this piece of film was made? It doesn't have a number on it, and so they'll explain that there's a series of X's and O's. And so we give a lot of information and encourage people to ask questions and realize that it might not be obvious at first, but that process is interesting, and there are things any of us can do, and at the same time that we have respect for experts who have spent years studying something.
Okay. So, I mean, if I have a picture from a Japanese officer to my grandfather, I mean, I could go do some research on it, but are there people around, like experts around, that I could take that to and they would help me do the research too?
Well, it sometimes takes a bit of effort to find the person who specializes in, for instance, these Japanese photographs, but we encourage people to think about different resources that they might not know about, that there are hundreds of different kinds of archives. There are specialized libraries. It's not as if going to the library is just one thing that will be replicated across the country. And to realize that there are certain questions that you want to ask that'll make it be easier for someone to help you out.
Perfect.
Let me just add one more thing on, because it's so important what you're saying. We also have on our website a lot of ways to help people be able to do this kind of research themselves, because there is such a widespread interest in taking these techniques of investigation and being able to use them as well as finding places to go. So take a look at the website.
I will do that. Thank you very much.
Oh,
I appreciate
very good.
It.
And there is if you're interested in finding out more about the program, you can go to their website. You can go through PBS, pbs.org, but I know that if you have internet access, you just put in your browser, History Detectives, you'll get there. And we will get to another caller. This is someone I believe they're on the campus on a cell phone, line three. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi. Yes.
Yes. I'm very glad I had the radio on this morning, because every time I see the show, I think the same thing. There is a lot of travel associated with the show. I was wondering about the logistics of all of that. I would say I'd take my answer off the air, but considering I'm on the cell phone, I'd like to hear your answer.
Yeah. Well, you're asking a very good question. There are two stages of travel and research. That is, we have an initial stage of trying to find out the nature and the depth of places we can go to investigate a particular question about an object. So we do a lot of travel at this early stage. We have a wonderful staff of young people at the office who help do these initial fieldings of questions. And then we have a very demanding and rigorous period, usually 5 or 6 days out in the field. So we've all done a lot of research to start off, often done some traveling as well as talking to people who are experts.
All that travel happens in only a week?
Yeah.
Wow.
Sometimes it'll be in several pieces. That we've sometimes spent 3 years doing this initial research, and we'll sometimes have the work of an investigation that we then film and show happen in 2 or 3 different times. But these are grueling days in which you're often up at 5 in the morning and going on until midnight, because they can only afford a certain number of days of traveling and hotels and so forth. But it's exciting because there are also things that we've worked out ahead of time and then things that happen right on site. And so we'll squeeze something else in, or we'll realize after we've done an investigation, we should add this on. So we take up a lot of traveling, but trying to be, like everyone these days, as economical as possible about how to do it.
Thank you very much.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. On to another caller. This is Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yeah, you wait a while to get on and you get your questions answered. Mine is actually, and leads up to that, what's the longest, in other words, in terms of time, that you put on solving one of these problems, or, you know, one of the three or whatever, you know, that you each week or some. What's the longest time that's been invested?
It's a wonderful question. There is one that took 3 years, which was the case of a group of archaeologists who were doing work on early towns in Virginia, discovered a house and then discovered a skeleton that had been crammed into the corner of the basement of the house. And it took years of doing research. And that was an instance of piecing together a probable end, and then that allowed new research to happen. So that was 3 years. And then another one that took 4 years is a story, one of my favorites, that was an artist who contacted us and had a little microchip that had miniatures of 6 drawings that he had asked friends of his to do. These were Oldenburg and Lichtenstein and Warhol, major artists, in the aftermath of Neil Armstrong walking on the moon. And he said this transformed our lives. We were thinking about space in different ways. And I think this was smuggled aboard Apollo 12 and taken to the moon. Now, can you find out if this is true? Well, that took many years of research. I thought it was a preposterous idea in the beginning. And I've come around to thinking that might well have happened by the kind of research that surprises me. And we'll often have this kind of response. Now, what's also interesting is at the end of it, I say I've got a lot of circumstantial evidence that suggests this could well have happened, but there's never absolute proof, but we don't know who the connection was. And I turn to the audience and say, we've spent years doing this. Does anybody out there know the person who used a pseudonym who probably smuggled this aboard one of the legs of the lunar landing module? And we got a lot of interesting ideas and somebody who might indeed be able to make that connection.
But that's still an open, that particular one is still an unanswered question.
Well, we've had a number of times where we go back to the contributor and say, I'm sorry, I can't answer your question. I can tell you this much, which is what all historians know happens much of the time. And it's, I think, encourage people to realize history is an ongoing process. There'll be new documents that you can find. And as one of the callers said, there are people whose documents weren't kept or ones who didn't know how to write. And so we have an ongoing process.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Gwendolyn Wright. She is one of the hosts of the PBS series History Detectives. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
2 years after the death of Joan Didion's husband, just after she completed a memoir about grieving, Didion lost her daughter. Now Didion's written a memoir about her daughter's death. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Joan Didion, and we hear from British actor Bill Nye, co-star of the BBC movie Page 8 that airs Sunday on PBS. Join us.
this afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. For 26 years, 10,000 Villages has been offering fairly traded gift items for family and friends, from coffee, tea, and chocolate, to a collection of personal accessories and home decor.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you. Let me just mention that tomorrow morning, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking with writer-journalist Siddhartha Deb about his new book, The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of India, which takes a look at India, life in India today, trying to go beneath the surface. Also, our regular monthly show on computers tomorrow, and that's an opportunity for you to call in and ask questions. Maybe you have a problem and you're not quite sure how to solve it. We'll see if we can help you out. James Eyrick will be with us and Deb Fleiger. James Eyrick is a security engineer with the National Center for Supercomputing Applications here on the campus. And Deb Fleiger is network engineer with CITES, the Campus Information Technologies and Education Services. So computer program problems tomorrow. And then Friday we'll do a show we actually had scheduled for earlier in the week. It didn't come off, but we will be doing it, talking with investigative journalist Catherine Eben about the problem of counterfeit prescription medications, something that's getting to be more and more of a problem. She wrote a book about it a number of years back titled Dangerous Doses. So she'll be with us Friday. And that will be, I believe, in the 10 o'clock hour. As I say, you can check up on the schedule. We're here. We've got 10 different topics each week. Check up on the schedule by going to the website, will.illinois.edu. The guest in this hour focus is Gwendolyn Wright. She's professor of architecture in Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. And she also has been, since the beginning, one of the hosts for the PBS television series History Detectives. And she'll be talking about the show and this approach to history in a talk tonight on the campus at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center. Her visit here is sponsored by the folks in the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. And questions are welcome, too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It's something you've touched on a number of times, but I wanted to come back to, which I think is an important point that has to do with what one does when one does history. People, I think they have the idea that, you know, history involves finding answers to questions and the answers being definitive. And it doesn't work that way. And I think the point you've made it and in talking about the show you've made it is that you may not always have the answer, or you may get an answer, but that may just raise more questions. And that's what history is about.
Well, David, it's very well put, because we are showing how historians think, how we work, and what becomes an ongoing process. To have a certain level of knowledge then allows you to ask other questions. It brings in other people saying, but I have this other point of view, or here's a different newspaper that saw that event in a different way. And it helps us in the present understand the complexity, the different points of view about the past, and the way in which gathering knowledge is an ongoing process. And of course, that's relevant in the present day, rather than just listening to one radio station or just taking on one point of view, asking ourselves, how can I question my own presumptions? It's not as if you should berate yourself, but how do you think about this from a different point of view, and what can you learn in that process?
I think it's important for people to understand that that's really what historians do. But it's also true, I think, that it bothers people. I think that the notion that once you have done your history and you've written your book, that that's not settled. And, you know, people talk about saying things like, well, I don't like history that's revisionist, people who maybe never would have used a term like that, because they've learned one version of things. And who knows? We reinterpret. We find new information. We say, well, maybe that wasn't quite right. And I think that people find that very unsettling. What do you say to people who say, well, why do you guys keep changing your mind? Or, you know, why is history not a settled sort of a thing.
Well, we wouldn't ask that of biology, would we? We understand that certain levels of knowledge allow us to ask a different set of questions. It's not as if it's wrong, but history is in the same base. We have enough knowledge to make what will always be provisional answers. And we often say, I'm 99% sure this is the case. But that allows us then not so much to be revisionist and say the earlier position was wrong, but to say that was the provision that the American government put out. But there were people in the government who had different points of view about the First World War and why we should enter, for instance. We discovered on that basis that there had been a major attack on American soil, actually 40 of them, but one that was so strong just off the lower Manhattan that it blew out all the windows in lower Manhattan and sank part of Ellis Island, and that Wilson knew this had happened by a group of Germans who wanted to stop our sending weapons to France. And so he suppressed the information because he was coming up for re-election, and his campaign promise was, I kept us out of war. And he knew that if people discovered this had happened, they would want to go to war against Germany. So it's not as if the way Wilson's approach to diplomacy that we have learned about was wrong. It helps us see other dimensions. And so our point is not to be revisionist or not to be post-structuralist and say we can never know anything about the past. It's all up for grabs. Everything is a lie. But to say it's an ongoing process of trying to see things from different points of view and having enough knowledge that we can then ask other questions. And again, I try to make the parallel with medicine and biology. We don't want to hold on to our ideas from the 19th century about human biology. We keep building new knowledge, and sometimes we can't say for sure what treatment you could use. That's hard. It's somewhat disconcerting, but it helps you then make an intelligent decision.
Well, I think if people do sometimes make the same complaints about science. They say that for at some point, some particular question in science, we have a certain answer. Then we collect more information, we do some more experiments, and maybe that we realize, well, that just wasn't right. And then people say, oh, you scientists, you know, you tell us one thing and then you tell us something else. Well, that's what scientists do. They are always asking questions. They're always saying and questioning what they know and saying, now, wait a minute. Now, how exactly do we know that? Are we sure about that? And, of course, you can do an experiment 100 times and have it come out one way. All it's got to happen was one time it not come out right, and that throws the whole thing out the window, or at least it makes you want to say, well, wait a minute, were we really right these other 99 times, or is something going on here we're not really sure about? That whole business that, you know, knowledge is always – the making of knowledge is an ongoing process. It never really stops. So there is no end of history. You know, there was no end of science. There is no end.
David, you hit it on the head by saying you'll have 99 examples of an experiment that keeps proving more and more definitively that certain things happen. And then the 100th is different, which gives us some insights into variations. Now, it's hard for most people. If you are sick, you want to have an answer. But a good doctor will say, I'm 99% sure this is the case, but you should get a second opinion about whether or not to have surgery. And doctors increasingly try to acknowledge the level of ambiguity that is there. And they realize that they wouldn't use the same medicine. You wouldn't want them to use the same medicine as in 1950, much less 1890. But it's harder because we have to make decisions that can never be absolutely sure.
Mm-hmm. That's though, going back to history, I think you do have to say that all views cannot carry the same weight. And I suppose that the thing is, in what way can you support making a particular kind of argument? You know, what kind of arguments can you marshal? What kind of evidence can you offer? What, you know, all right, so don't just say, I think this, make your case for that, and that has to happen.
Well, David, I'll give you an example that 40 years ago, we didn't have the history of women. It was seen as being a minor aspect of what happened. It didn't make any difference. Now, that has changed so fundamentally. It's not just that women have been brought into history, but you can't teach the history of the Revolutionary War or the Civil War without bringing in the role that women played. It doesn't mean the other was wrong. It just gives us a new dimension. Now, I'll give you an example that's very amusing, that a couple of years ago, my colleague Tukufu Zuberi, who's a wonderful sociologist at Penn, had taken on a story of two women, two elderly women in the South, whose historical society had a sword that they had heard belonged to Andrew Jackson. So they wanted him to find out if it was true. And he did investigations. And in these cases, he could be pretty definitive to say the company that made this did not come into existence until 20 years after Jackson had died. So I can say pretty definitively it wasn't. And the two women took the sword and said, "Well, thank you so much, Mr. Zuberi, but we'll just continue to believe what we want to believe." And that's part of history, too. After all, we have gone to war for myths, for untruths about racial difference, about the meaning of nationalism. So it's also a matter of getting past this idea of fact versus fiction, that human history has been driven by myths and disbeliefs as well as by accuracy of facts. We have to take that into account as part of history.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Indiana on our line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you could come up with something from perhaps your own investigations comparable to the problem they had in physics where the black body radiation didn't go the way it should according to basically Newtonian physics, and you had to finally come up with quantum mechanics. Is there anything like that's happened in history or even in architecture or history of architecture, anything like that, where all of a sudden it's an extreme about face that one has to do and take to make sure that the people understand actually what was going on in the period that you're looking at? Thank you.
Well, it's a fascinating question. I don't know enough about physics to fully grasp what that change was, but as far as I can guess, you're saying we haven't had that kind of radical change in terms of a knowledge about history or even about architecture. At least I don't think so. And that's in part because we're in a different aspect of dealing with evidence, where physics is dealing often with abstractions of things that we cannot see. So there is more speculation about what happened and why. And that can be overturned more easily than an approach to knowledge that deals with certain facts and then tries to add on others, that deals with certain dominant interpretations, but then brings in other points of view. But those interpretations have weight, and therefore we don't totally turn them over, at least as far as I can understand the question.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'd think that there, in many cases, there at least would be certain things that had been so thoroughly researched and written about that there was so much data that there was no what new really, you know, say like a question which continues to be contentious, like what really was the cause of the Civil War and what was the Civil War all about? What really are we going to learn new to try to answer that question? Or is there any data that we don't already have that you can use to answer a question like that?
Well, you're asking several questions, David.
I'm sorry.
One of them is the fact that we have certain data, and that is historically valid. So quite often, history is a matter of bringing in other points of view or looking at sometimes outright deceit and sometimes a lack of understanding, and therefore public presentations about that. And the cause of wars is certainly one of them. Now, I loved doing this story about the Civil War doll that might have been a way of carrying quinine and especially morphine because there were so many amputations that were being done during the war. I liked that because it forced me to look at the history of the Civil War from the point of view of the Southerners, which I had had a hard time, I admit, just by my personal beliefs doing, and helped me understand the intensity of their commitment to this. But most importantly, it helped me understand the war off the battlefield. Now, this is probably a radical change because we've always looked at military history from the point of view of battlefield strategies. This brought up not only the role of women, but something extraordinary. In the Civil War, more people died of disease and infection than died on the battlefield. And we have not brought that into account at all. And it becomes obviously an issue about how we think of the importance of public health in the present as in the past. That has not been incorporated, for the most part, in historical thinking.
Really? Because I'm sure I've heard that factoid before, that indeed more people died just because they got sick than died because they got shot. Why is it that hasn't somehow been brought in?
Well, it's not seen as in the purview of doing history. And if there's a weakness, historians, like any other group, tend to look at things from the things that we study. That is, we have certain points of view. That's fine. But it's unfortunate when that prevents us from looking at things from another point of view. And we'll say that's not important or there isn't real data on that. And so there are ways of convincing ourselves, even as professional historians or professional biologists, that certain things are important and other things really aren't. And so this pushes us to do what a good scholar will do. That is to question your own beliefs as well as trying to bring in new knowledge.
Yeah. Well, and that's, it does, going back to the idea of science, it does make me think about the fact that occasionally scientific researchers are criticized because they have done some experiments and they've collected their data, and then that certain bits of data that don't fit, they say, we're going to toss that out. That's no good. Well, I suppose the parallel, I'm sure, would happen in history. When you're looking at a particular time or a particular question, you assemble facts. And if there are some that just don't quite conveniently fit the view that you have in mind, you say, well, that's really not all that important.
Well, that's human. We all tend to do that. And I think as we get older and as we're educated in certain fields, you learn to respect certain knowledge. But if you're good, you learn to question yourself primarily. We have a human tendency to want to validate our own points of view. But perhaps the strongest example of how this happens has to do with the economy, that in the last 50 years in particular, we have thought about the economy in ways that was primarily the global financial economy. And other aspects, household economies, regional economies, were put aside as unimportant. They were bracketed out to do certain kinds of studies, but then economists said they're totally minor. They don't make any difference. And look what we ended up with by not taking account of the multiple economies that coexist in the world.
About 5-6 minutes left in this part of the show. Gwendolyn Wright is our guest. She's an architectural and cultural historian. She's one of the hosts of the PBS television series History Detectives. And we have a caller here, someone in Urbana. We will make sure we get them on our line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I guess I should start by saying that this is by far my favorite show, and Gwendolyn's probably my favorite host.
I'm touched by that. Thank you.
Tokufu did one that concerned a baseball diamond in New Jersey a while back, and he makes a series of comments in there that imply that in 1950, black people didn't vote. And, of course, everybody knows they were all Democrats. And there's some basic factual problems with this series of statements. That is, in 1950, in the North, black people did vote. And they almost all were Republicans because the Democratic Party had fought a war in defense of slavery and was the party of slavery or segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And somebody should have just done some basic fact-checking before that thing was aired. And I guess that's all I wanted to say.
Well, he and I did that one together. It was the second episode that we filmed. You're right. It's one of the points that was difficult for me and for all of us in knowing different kinds of history. Tokufu is an extraordinary scholar, but he's an Africanist. So he was brought on to give a different point of view as an African-American, but to also raise the kinds of issues about social differences. To my mind, it was important because he was looking at certain aspects of how Jim Crow worked, and in particular about how elections worked. And we were making a point of view about the importance of the African-American electorate. Now, he let slip a comment that was inaccurate, and it should have gotten picked up. We were still building our staff of people to do fact-checking. What is important, though, is the show was looking at the fact that this little baseball stadium was built by the machine boss in Atlantic City to try to get the African-American vote. So we were making your point, but he let something slip that was inaccurate. All of us do things. Sometimes you say, how did I say that? Because you'll have slipped and said something even that you know wasn't right. And we were building up this this staff and approach of how to take thousands of facts that we have and double check some of them. So it was as much my fault by not remembering that that had gotten in. We also didn't have a way of those of us who were on the who were among the historians. At that point, we didn't have access to the final piece. And so if I had had a chance to go over that last cut when that comment was brought in, it was a disparity with our main story. But sometimes things slip in. And we've also learned and try to say we made a mistake, because that does happen. And to therefore encourage the public to raise those issues, not hopefully to disparage the show because of it, but to see that this this confusion can sometimes happen. So I appreciate what you're saying, and I acknowledge the truth of it.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. And so do you get letters? I'm sure you must get letters from people saying about some particular program, some detail in there saying, no, you got that wrong?
We do, and we sometimes have we address those issues either on the website or occasionally we're exploring ways now to bring those up in discussions. There were a couple of instances early on where I got very upset about the interpretation, and we've learned now to predict those. The first year, as you can imagine, we were creating this program as we went along. We didn't really know we'd changed the topic, we had changed the name of it. We were figuring out how to bring in these different kinds of history. So there are a few weaknesses, but that, again, is one of the aspects of history we've been talking about. How do we look at the limitations and even the mistakes that people can make as part of that process?
Well, we're going to have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. But if you would like to hear more from our guest, Gwendolyn Wright, she's one of the hosts of the PBS television series History Detectives. She'll be giving a talk on, I'm sure, many of these same issues tonight at 7:30 on the University of Illinois campus and the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. She is professor of architecture in Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture Planning and Preservation. And if you're interested in finding out more about the show, you can go to their website. Either you can go to pbs.org or you can just type into your browser History Detectives and you'll find their site and get more information about it. And you can look for that show, whatever public TV station you watch, including ours, WILO-TV, you can look for the show History Detectives. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David, and thanks to all the people who've called in. These have been very exciting questions, including this last one, bringing up weaknesses in the history and evolution of the show. That's part of history that we're a part of, too.